It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
You have legs.
We have two more hours of this.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Welcome to episode 854. Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, March 24th, 2024. I am the Solo Monster as we get ever so closer to WrestleMania. Thank you for tuning in and downloading the podcast each and every week. We crack the top 10 again this week for all wrestling podcasts anywhere in the world on Apple Podcasts. That does not happen without you, so thank you for that. We got our usual round of news to get into this week. We're going to be talking about Ronda Rousey, going to be talking about Bill Goldberg, some free agents that are hitting the market at the end of the month and could be landing maybe in WWE, maybe in AEW. We don't know yet. We'll talk about that. Plus, this week's Dark Side of the Ring covered the final flight of the Freebird, Terry Gordy. And we'll get into a whole bunch of mailbag questions. I got the mailbag back this week. First, I want to say thank you to our PayPal producers, anybody who donated this week. I am very much appreciative of the support. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. You can always head to thesolomonster.com, and you will find the link at the top of the link tree. I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, who dropped the hammer on me this week. Paul, thank you, man. Wow. Big B, Brian Becerra, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Undeniable, Samantha Turner, Carlos Man of Steel, Manuel, I hope things are well, my friend, Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills, Night Stalker, Naif Al Safar, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, I hope you and Mama Eichard had a blast at SmackDown, they were in Milwaukee on Friday, Big Homie, Jonathan Burton, it's good to hear from you, dude, Best in the Game, Trey Porter, Killshot, Keith Hart, Tough Guy, Temjin Zephyr, I did see the new Alien Romulus trailer. It looks badass. I think it picks up after the first movie, I believe. After Alien, but before Aliens. I think that's the timeline. I'll probably see it when it comes out. You wanted to know my thoughts on the new trailer that dropped this week. Casey is Raw. Just turned 42. Casey, I hope you had a great birthday. Casey has also got a YouTube channel where he does retro gameplays and he does video game hunting. It's hunting season. He's also got a live podcast he does on Saturdays called Saturday is Raw. So you can give that a watch on YouTube. And some of you may recognize the name Oz and Glorious from our YouTube streams. What you may not know is that he performs in a band. And that band's name is Iota. They're based out of Salt Lake City. They just released a new record on Friday called Pentasomnia. And he would love it, and so would I, if our Sound Off family could check out their new music video, which is on YouTube. Their track is called The Timekeeper. You can find it on the YouTube channel for Small Stone Records. That's all one word for Small Stone. Small Stone Records. I think the visuals on the video are great, and I think you guys are going to really like it. So leave a comment on the video when you get there. Let them know the Solo Monster sent you. One more time, Becky Lynch's new book is available right now on Audible. You can get it for free. Or the new Ronda Rousey book that's been making headlines. It's called My Fight, and it drops on April 2nd, but you can pre-order it right now. You can get either book for free or both books for free if you are an Amazon Prime member just by signing up for the 30-day Audible trial with my link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. You gotta sign up for the trial first or else it doesn't count. And if you should decide to cancel before those 30 days are up, you don't get billed and you get to keep both of your free books. So get on that. audibletrial.com/solomonster. Before we get into the news, I've got a fun announcement to make. I'm very excited about. So WrestleMania week is going to be a busy one. Fox Sports Radio in Philadelphia. The station there is Fox Sports The Gambler, which is the destination for sports talk in the Philly area. They are getting in on the action, And that Tuesday afternoon, I am going to be remoting in to chat with Sean Brace, who does their afternoon show every weekday from 3 to 6 p.m. And you'll be able to catch me on there. And that's pretty cool. But also, that Thursday, April 4th, I will be in Philadelphia at the iHeart Studio there, more specifically in their Duncan Lounge, doing my WrestleMania 40 predictions. And it's a small, intimate space. It's very cool. They usually have musicians in there doing some live songs in front of a small audience. I will not be singing my predictions. Nobody wants to hear that. But I will be talking all things WrestleMania. I believe they may be able to stream the video live on their YouTube channel, but I'll be able to grab the video of it myself after and throw it up on my channel later that day so everybody can see it. And the other cool part about this, you can join in person. Space is very limited, though. I mean, we're talking maybe 2 dozen people at the most. But if you live in the area, or if you are going to be in town for WrestleMania and you're coming in early, if you're going to be in that Thursday, I'm probably starting around 1 o'clock. Just get in touch. Let me know if you want to attend. I want to take some audience questions too, make it a little interactive. Now, I'm sure they can get people, but I would love to have some Sound Off fans in there with me. So it is the Duncan Lounge at iHeartRadio's studio location. The address is 2 Bala Plaza, Suite PL50. That's P as in Paul, L50. In Bala Cynwyd, Pennsylvania. Bala Cynwyd is right on the Philadelphia Main Line. It's about a 20-minute drive to and from Lincoln Financial Field, just to give you a sense of where it is. When you get there, security can direct you on where to go, but you are invited to attend. Just reach out and let me know so I can give them a sense of what we're looking at here. And I may have more to announce on this soon. I don't want to say anything until I know for sure. But then on Friday, April 5th at 3 p.m., I will be in Philly for the joint show with House of Glory and Wrestling Revolver. It's our first Philly show. We've got Mustafa Ali taking on Amazing Red for the first time ever. And then I get to drive right back to New York so I can be home in time for WrestleMania Night 1. And I can be live for all of you on YouTube after Night 1 and Night 2. And somewhere in the middle of all that madness, I've got to do a podcast too. I don't know how, but it will get done. So Thursday and Friday in Philly, I hope I get to see you guys there. And my thanks to the Fox Sports crew there for having me. It's going to be a lot of fun. I mentioned the new Ronda Rousey book that drops on April 2nd, just in time for WrestleMania. Even though the book is not out yet, it is already making headlines, and it is all the wrong headlines for WWE. In the book, she blasts Vince McMahon, she blasts John Laurinaitis, and she blasts Bruce Pritchard. She really does not like Bruce Pritchard. That much is very clear. You know, after the Janelle Grant lawsuit was filed and Vince resigned from TKO, is when Ronda went on Twitter and said that if Bruce is still with the company, then Vince McMahon still has a hand in running it, because Bruce is basically Vince's avatar. And she claimed Vince was still running things through Bruce when he was quote-unquote gone the first time, which would have been after those first stories in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago. One thing that is clear from that tweet and all of these new statements in the book is that Ronda Rousey has zero fucks left to give and has no intention of ever going back to WWE. Now, that doesn't mean that she won't eventually go back to WWE or that she won't eventually be inducted into the Hall of Fame. We know how the word never, you know, usually never is a very careful term that you have to use when it comes to pro wrestling. But she doesn't care. She doesn't care what bridges that she may burn in the process. She has made her money, she had her fun, and she got out. Now, excerpts of her new book started spreading this week, and here's one of them. And I got a few of them here, but let's start with this one. NXT was founded by and under the control of Triple H, real name Paul Levesque. In addition to being my in-ring WrestleMania nemesis, he is arguably one of the best professional wrestlers in history and one of the better people on the business side. He is married to Stephanie McMahon, who is the daughter of WWE's Emperor Palpatine, Vince McMahon. Vince took over the company from his father in the early 1980s and spent the better part of 40 years playing a real-world pro wrestling version of Monopoly, buying up and absorbing smaller promotions until he basically owned them all. It's hard sometimes to know where the evil, unethical, slimeball character of Vince McMahon played out for the cameras ends and the actual questionably ethical, many times sued and multiple times accused of sexual misconduct Vince McMahon begins. That blurred line between character and reality is a recurring theme within the WWE universe. Now in another excerpt, she says, pay-per-views are held in major cities like New York, Los Angeles, and Philadelphia, as well as now twice a year in Saudi Arabia, a nation that restricts the rights of women in a way that I'm certain Vince McMahon wishes he could. So not mincing any words when it comes to Vince McMahon. And that's all right with me, because more people should speak up about Vince McMahon. I wish more people spoke up about him when he was still there. But I understand why they didn't. Vince was the king. It's like Omar said in The Wire, you come at the king, you best not miss. Especially if you were a woman. Here's more from Rhonda. WWE loves to do well-produced video segments about the legacy of women within the organization, but the truth is, women have largely been footnotes. For the longest time, they were relegated to serving male characters in a valet role, an overly sexualized supporting character that takes cheap shots when the ref isn't looking. Over time, as the level of female talent grew and society as a whole started to shift, the organization gradually expanded the role of female wrestlers. WWE bills itself as a sports entertainment organization, and just like in the mainstream entertainment industry, there was, by all accounts, a casting couch culture where men backstage in powerful positions pressured female talent for sexual favors in return for airtime. There were so many public accusations and scandals, it's hard to keep track, and more than I am sure, WWE managed to sweep under the ring. Now, it's important to point out, when she says that, and talks about there being a casting couch culture, she's not saying that this was happening during her time in the company, which is why she uses the words, by all accounts. It reads to me like she's giving her readers a sense of how things used to be in the company. That's why she gave that background on Vince and talked about him eating up all the territories. This is how it used to be in WWE. Some of those scandals and public accusations that she alludes to, by the way, involved male talents who worked for WWE. We're not just talking female talents here. And look at what happened to some of those people. Look at Randy Orton's uncle, Barry. Back in the 80s, he got blackballed for rejecting the sexual advances of Terry Garvin, another piece of garbage that Vince McMahon employed for years and years. So if men were blackballed, the women didn't stand a chance. If you were a woman in WWE, you were always at a disadvantage to begin with, because up until a few years ago, the women were not a priority in that company, not to Vince McMahon. Not to him, they weren't. They were expendable, all of them. Go back even further to the Diva Search era, right? Kevin Dunn's Pride and Joy. They were nothing more than eye candy on camera, and they were play toys to these people off camera. And if you wanted to keep your job, then you were well advised to keep your mouth shut. That's why a lot of this stuff was swept under the ring, as she says, for so long, and why we're only hearing about some of these stories now. Yeah, the thing is, even if there was a Ronda Rousey back then, who spoke up and didn't care about the consequences, didn't care what the repercussions would be, I don't think it would have made that much of a difference. I think they would have simply been dismissed as difficult to work with. They would have been blackballed from the company, and Vince would have gone on making his millions. I really don't think things would have changed all that much. What I do wonder, though, as I read this and I hear Rhonda taking all these shots and saying all these things, I do wonder when Rhonda started feeling this way, because she left for 3 years, right? She left. I think she wanted to go start a family. And 3 years later, she came back to the company. If she felt this strongly about Vince McMahon during her first run there, it's tough to call the man the devil incarnate and still justify going back to work for him and getting paid by him. You know, even if she was mostly dealing with Triple H, which I assume she was, I mean, the book is not out yet, so I don't know if she'll get into the details of who she did and did not deal directly with. But if she thought this man was such a snake, she still went back to work for him. I guess the money was just too good to pass up. But she continued to say the company only began giving female talent more airtime after they were forced into it. She said it was only after WWE was basically armbarred into it, following a global social media backlash to hashtag Give Divas a Chance, after divas were given a total of 30 seconds, less time than it takes most people to read this paragraph, for a nationally televised tag match. Four women were given less time to collectively wrestle than every single man on the roster got for his intro music alone. Presented this information as a person outside of the wrestling world, you might draw the conclusion that there is a troubling, foundational, sexist, patriarchal culture within WWE. You would be right. I have nothing but respect for the female wrestlers who paved the way for women today, and nothing but disgust for the amount of sexist, degrading bullshit they were put through. Ronda is not wrong when she says the company had to basically be armbarred into pushing women's wrestling. How many years did we have Divas matches on TV where the women were already being told to go home before they even got out of Gorilla to make their entrance? That was really happening. That's not an exaggeration. There were women who were standing there getting ready to go through the curtain to make their entrance and were already being told by people at the Gorilla position to basically go home. That when you get to the ring, your match is already mostly over. Right? Got to get the women on the show. There you go. You got your 30 seconds. This was commonplace. And then they would probably justify it by saying that they weren't over enough, which is just, we've heard about this before. I mean, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because how are they supposed to get over if you're only giving them 30 seconds to begin with? They never wanted to have an all-women's WrestleMania main event. It only came about because they signed Ronda Rousey. That's what cracked the door open and finally allowed them to walk through it. Ronda came along at just the right time, because that summer is when Becky Lynch caught fire, and then they started going at each other on social media. Everybody was talking about it. Everybody wanted to see them go one-on-one. By the time Becky won the Royal Rumble, people were fully into the idea of seeing them at WrestleMania. It felt like a big match worthy of the top billing on that show. Now, in another excerpt from the book, she recalled a specific time where she and some of the other women confronted Bruce Pritchard over comments that he allegedly made to former WWE star Aaliyah. Rousey writes that Liv Morgan approached her and other superstars after seeing that Aaliyah was upset by comments allegedly made to her by Pritchard. "I was rehearsing in the ring with some of the other girls before doors opened to the fans when Liv made a beeline to the ring from Gorilla. 'Have you seen Aaliyah?' she asked. We shook our heads. Aaliyah had come up to SmackDown the year before. She had been partnered with Raquel Rodriguez and they briefly held the tag team titles, but then Aaliyah was sidelined with a shoulder injury. I just ran into her, almost hysterically crying," Morgan explained. "She was asking if it's true that none of the talents want to work with her. We exchanged confused looks. I didn't know Aaliyah well, but I had nothing but great interactions with her. She was one of the sweetest girls in the locker room. 'Why would she think that?' I asked. Morgan responded, 'They wanted her to come back from her shoulder injury right away, but she said she needed more time.' That's when Bruce Pritchard told her that all the producers were trying to bury her and nobody wanted to work with her. She was really upset. I felt my jaw and fists clench at the mere mention of his name. Bruce Pritchard was another Vince McMahon crony. If 'What did you say you do here?' was a person, it would be him. No one knew what exactly his job was or how he got it. He was the type of guy who carries a briefcase just so it looks like he's doing something, yet somehow he had wormed his way up to executive producer, handpicked by Vince because he knew Bruce was the kind of guy you could control from a distance through an earpiece." Ronda went on to say that she, Bayley, and Liv Morgan all went over to speak to Pritchard, who was by the announce desk. When Morgan got Pritchard's attention, his response was described as, quote, "with the expression of a man who was annoyed to be interrupted by a bunch of chicks until he saw my even more bothered expression. He pivoted to force a smile." Morgan told Pritchard that all the girls love Aaliyah and reiterated that no one is saying anything negative about her. Following Morgan's more polite address, Rousey also had something to say. She said, "I stood behind Liv, my arms crossed like an enforcer. Bruce's strained grin held. He had the air of a failed used car salesman. I cleared my throat to send a message, not because I needed to cough. And I would really appreciate it if you weren't taking other people's word at face value and speaking for us, I said. In fact, I would appreciate it if you didn't talk to anyone about what we said unless we said it to you. You have a question about that, you talk to us. He nodded too enthusiastically. I love Aaliyah, he almost shouted. She's great. Yeah, I have no idea where that came from. He looked around as if he was actually looking for someone to pin the blame on. The other girls and I exchanged, can you believe this guy looks? I'll talk to her, he said, as if to say that it was all a misunderstanding. I nodded, lingering just a little bit longer than the other ladies once they turned to leave. I would make sure to give Aaliyah a hug the next time I saw her, I thought to myself. But I never saw Aaliyah again. After that night, she all but disappeared, as if she vanished into thin air, even long after her shoulder had healed. It sent a clear message. In the organization's eyes, talent was disposable. Aaliyah was released. It was September of last year. That was a full year after her last match. And I don't think she's wrestled a match since. I don't know what went into the thought process of releasing her. You know, she was in developmental for a long time. And then they finally called her up, and look, she was far from the best person on the roster. But it was a little weird how she got hurt, lost the tag belts with Raquel. That was in September of 2022, and an entire year went by. And they did nothing with her. And like I said, she didn't work any matches. And then they just let her go. Now, when Ronda calls Bruce Vince's avatar, she is not wrong. Bruce Pritchard worked for Vince McMahon for so many years as one of his right-hand men. He was a stooge. He was one in a long line of yes-men, which is how he got to keep his job for so long. So when she says she doesn't know how he got the job or how he's been there for so long, that's how. He was smart enough to learn how to survive working for Vince McMahon. And you don't survive working for Vince McMahon by disagreeing with him very often. So Bruce was very good at that. And that's why he survived for as long as he has. So when she says that, so long as Bruce is still there, Vince McMahon will always have some connection to the company. He does, but I don't know that it necessarily means that Bruce is feeding him any information. And maybe he still keeps in contact with Vince. I don't know. Ronda doesn't know because she's not there anymore. And even if she was, nobody can be sure unless you check the man's text messages or you check his emails. I know Sean Ross Sapp at a Q&A for Fightful Select the other day. He was asked about Ronda's remarks, and he did say that some of the comments that she made were debunked. I don't know what that means, or what supposedly was debunked and by who. But the fact is, Vince McMahon has no power anymore. There really is nothing in it for Bruce to still be doing anything like that, other than just blind loyalty. You know, Vince McMahon already left once and came back. Maybe he wants to stay on Vince's good side because you just never know. Right, I know Mark Shapiro said he's not here anymore and he's never coming back, but this guy already survived before, and so who knows? Bruce may be like, yeah, I'm not getting on this guy's bad side because one day he may be my boss again, okay? You just never know. But he is very lucky to still have a job because if Endeavor really wanted a clean house of everybody from the old regime, Vince is gone, Laurinaitis is gone, Kevin Dunn is gone, Bruce would be gone too. But apparently Triple H likes him. Now, Ronda did a 20-minute interview with her co-author, Maria Burns Ortiz, who also happens to be her sister, and talked about, quote, how much of an absolute shit show it is at the WWE. They can't hold a sword over my head and hold me hostage with my own career. I don't need anything from them, and I don't intend on going back. I can say everything I think and feel where everyone else that is held captive by their organization cannot. She said that she was held back on saying even more about her experiences in WWE than she did in the book due to a contractual word count. And she specifically took aim at John Laurinaitis and Bruce Pritchard, who she, quote, said she was going to talk so much more shit about, saying in an earlier part of the interview that the two of them can go fuck themselves. In that same interview, she revealed that her career ended due to concussions that she first started suffering during her judo career. She said that she had to keep them a secret for years so that she could continue to compete and perform, adding that WWE has a complicated history with their talents getting concussed, so she felt that she couldn't talk about it. And that's scary. Makes you wonder how many other people in WWE, or AEW, for that matter, are hiding the number of concussions that they've had for fear that they may not be allowed to perform anymore. I'm sure a lot of that still goes on. When I look back at Ronda Rousey's run in WWE, it really is the tale of two runs. Her first run was far better than her second run, and her first run was actually historically significant because there were never... I mean, there was just never a chance that there would have been an all-women's pay-per-view were it not for Ronda Rousey being in the main event of that show. And they only did one. But that show never would have taken place. That Evolution show never would have happened if they did not have Ronda Rousey on their roster and they could promote her as being in the main event. And the women would not have main evented WrestleMania 35 were it not for Ronda Rousey. WrestleMania only became a two-night event after the pandemic hit. So I think it was inevitable the women would have had the chance to headline a WrestleMania sometime after that. But that 2019 WrestleMania was not two nights. It was still one night. And if you take Ronda Rousey out of that show, the main event that year does not involve Becky Lynch. The main event that year does not involve Charlotte Flair. The main event that year is very likely Seth Rollins against Brock Lesnar. That first match that Ronda had the previous year at WrestleMania in New Orleans was the match of the night. That tag team match was excellent, with her and Kurt Angle against Triple H and Stephanie. And she went on later that year, had a great match with Charlotte Flair at Survivor Series. Then Becky got her face broken, got even more over, and there was a genuine excitement to see her and Ronda go at it. And then they added Charlotte to the match, which watered things down, and they had that botched finish, but Ronda put Becky over on her way out. And if her run would have ended there, I think people would have had a much more favorable view of her career, short as it was. But when she came back in 2022, the whole thing was botched from the start. With the reaction she was getting, she should have been a heel. And then her and Charlotte went out and had a terrible match at WrestleMania. Everything about that second run was underwhelming. And it was pretty clear that she was past the point of giving a shit who she pissed off, because while she was working there, she was making comments to the New York Post after she and Shayna Baszler won the women's tag team titles about the lack of competition and how dismally shallow the women's division was and how their biggest challenge was to get the company to care enough to invest in the tag team division. She said they were trying to turn chicken shit into chicken salad. Then March of last year, she wrote on social media that her program with Liv Morgan was hamstrung by a bunch of octogenarians who still think they know how to be hip while putting less than 5 minutes of thought a week into each women's storyline. Now, it's one thing to say these things after working there, after you're done, and you go home. She was saying it while she was working there. And good on her for saying it. I wish there were more people who had that attitude. But her name and her notoriety, that worked to her advantage in that way. She could get away with it in a way that someone like Meechin or Liv Morgan or Dakota Kai would not be able to. You think WWE would have tolerated any of them talking to the New York Post like that? Or going on Twitter and burying their bosses like that? Yeah, with Rousey, oh, it's just Ronda being Ronda, leave it alone. We don't want to piss her off. If it was any of those other women, they'd be sitting home for the next 90 days collecting their downside guarantee before hitting the indie scene. With Vince McMahon being gone, most of his cronies being gone, most, not all, I sincerely hope that things are different now. I hope that culture that she talks about is a relic of the past. And that more people speak up like she did if they see something or they hear something that should not be happening. She speaks positively of Triple H. They worked together when Ronda first came in. They worked together in 2015 when Ronda confronted Triple H and Stephanie in that segment with The Rock at WrestleMania 31. She was probably working closely with Triple H from the moment they brought her in. But along the way, she lost that something special about her. She became just another, you know, face in the division, another member of the roster. She got to experience firsthand how the creative process works for everybody else, and she didn't like it. And that's when she probably decided that she was leaving. Then she went scorched earth because she knew she was never coming back. I'm sure people will call her bitter, but that doesn't make what she's saying here any less true, especially about the old boys club that was in power there for so long. Eventually, the trash has a way of taking itself out. Speaking of trash, Bill Goldberg appeared on Tim Green's Nothing Left Unsaid podcast. Tim Green played for the Atlanta Falcons at the same time that Goldberg did. He was diagnosed a few years ago with ALS. He just started a new show with his son, which was pretty amazing to watch him. If you actually watch the interview, to watch him communicating only with his eyes. I know they have devices that allow people with ALS to use their eye movement to trigger certain letters and certain words. So you could hear his voice. They had his actual voice programmed in there, even though he can't actually speak anymore. He's just speaking in a different way. Now, I know this technology is not new, but it's still pretty incredible to see it in action if you're not familiar with it. But anyway, on the podcast, Goldberg made it very clear that he did not and does not like Triple H. And he brought up some things that he directly links to Triple H not liking him. One such thing involved his undefeated streak from WCW. He brought up the fact that WWE had, quote, some Japanese girl beat his undefeated streak. Now, he was talking about his second run with the company. This is when he came back in 2016. He said, well, a girl beat my winning streak. Beat my undefeated streak. I can't even remember. Asuka was her name. Some Japanese girl. And they touted her as being the one to have the longest winning streak. And it just so happened that it culminated when I got there. This is from the same Bill Goldberg, who tweeted back at Asuka, not Asuka, congratulating her and telling her the streak is in very good hands. That was in response at the time to Asuka tweeting that she respects Goldberg so much and she called him amazing. If only that respect could be reciprocated. He knows exactly who Asuka is, and yet he disrespects the woman by mispronouncing her name and referring to her as some Japanese girl. That Japanese girl has more wrestling talent in her left ass cheek than Goldberg has in his entire body. Not to mention the fact that he has no idea what he's talking about. Goldberg came back to the company in 2016. Asuka did not pass his streak until May of 2017. It was at an NXT live event over Bianca Belair. So I'm not sure how he figures it culminated when he got there. His run was already over by that point. He didn't come back again until the following year. After his match with Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania, he came out on Raw the next night, he did a promo, and he left. And then a month later, a month and a half later, Asuka then passed his streak. So I'm not sure how he figures it culminated when he got there. But his conspiracy theory, I guess, is that Triple H had Asuka beat his streak at the same time that he came back to the company. Which would mean, now think about this, this would mean that Triple H was conspiring to break Goldberg's streak as far back as 2015, when Asuka's streak first began. And he had to also know that Goldberg would come back to the company the following year. Perhaps Triple H is from the future. I mean, he did dress up as the Terminator for his match with Sting at WrestleMania, so maybe he really is. I think Goldberg may have headbutted one too many lockers, because what he is saying doesn't even make sense. And by the way, Goldberg's 173-0 streak is complete horseshit. WCW started embellishing wins for him to pad the streak, and the fans started to catch on to what they were doing. So whatever the genuine number is, Asuka would have passed it long before Goldberg came back to the company anyway. But in the same interview, Goldberg expanded on his Triple H conspiracy theory by pointing out that, well, you know, so many people started using the spear. He said, and then it just so happened that every single wrestler uses the spear in their moves, right? Pretty ironic that happened when I got there, right? Well, of course. I mean, don't you remember Edge first using the spear in 2016? Even though he had already been retired for 5 years? Or how about when Rhino first started using the gore that same year? Or Lashley? Or Batista? Or Roman Reigns? Or anyone else who was already using the move for years before Goldberg came back? No. It only happened right at the moment of his return. That damn Triple H. See, I'll tell you what's going on here. Bill is salty. He's very salty that he never got the retirement match that Vince McMahon supposedly promised him. He said that he got the call to wrestle Roman Reigns in Saudi Arabia on 2 weeks' notice and he had COVID at the time. And he only agreed to put Roman over if Vince promised him and gave him a retirement match. So he went and he put Roman over. Vince never gave him a retirement match. And so he's been bitching about it ever since. So Vince McMahon told him what he wanted to hear in order to get him to do what he wanted, and then he lied to him. Bret Hart knows all about that, but somehow I don't think Bret is going to be sympathetic to Goldberg. Vince McMahon and WWE do not owe shit to Bill Goldberg. The man got paid very well to work a very select number of matches per year. When he came back, he said he wanted to come back for one reason. He wanted to come back so that his son could see him wrestle. He came back, he beat Brock Lesnar in 90 seconds, and his son got to see him play Superman. He got what he wanted. And then he stuck around. He got one last championship run, and then he and Brock got their redemption arc at WrestleMania to make up for that terrible match, that shit show that they had in 2004. WrestleMania 33 would have been the perfect way for him to ride off into the sunset, but he kept cashing those fat checks and coming back to do whatever they wanted him to do, and that included burying The Fiend, that included him nearly killing The Undertaker, and that included him wrestling Roman Reigns for the Universal title. In fact, 7 of his last 10 matches in WWE were championship matches. And yeah, he may have lost the majority of those, but I would say between that and them putting him in the Hall of Fame in 2018, WWE treated him very well during that last run, especially considering how much animosity there was the way he left in 2004. So for him to go on a podcast and cry conspiracy over the way he was treated is beyond absurd. If he wants a retirement match so bad, I hope Triple H brings him back and has Bron Breakker spear the fuck out of him. WWE is bringing back the Slammy Awards for WrestleMania, we found out this week. It's going to be part of the WrestleMania 40 festivities. It will make its return with a live broadcast from WWE World in Philadelphia on Sunday, April 7th. And the show is going to be hosted by Big E and Kathy Kelly. And it will stream on WWE's YouTube channel and other social media platforms. This is the first time they're doing the Slammy since 2020. But the Slammys go all the way back to the 1980s, and something that I always found very amusing is, I remember as a kid, when I was first starting to watch wrestling, so we're talking right around 87, they had the Slammy Awards, and they used to call them like the 36th annual or 37th annual Slammy Awards, even though it was like the first one or the second one. But it was done up like a real award show ceremony, and they had like this big banquet hall, and you know, they did it up all nice, and one of my earliest wrestling memories is actually from the Slammy Awards. I believe it was in 1987. They did this show-long brawl between Hacksaw Jim Duggan and King Harley Race, where they were on stage and they brawled into the back. And I'm sure it was all pre-taped and everything, but I mean, they were fighting with all kinds of weapons. I think Race may have thrown a live chicken at Duggan at one point. And then they ended up in a different part of the building, and Bobby Heenan was part of all this. They ended up like in the wardrobe area. And then it all culminated where during the actual ceremony, they came blasting through like a wall or whatever it was on stage. And they were just covered in just, you know, powder and all. It's the 80s, so who knows what kind of powder it was, but just completely ridiculous. But I look back on that and it was so much fun to watch that. It was just pure insanity. So that's one of my earliest wrestling memories, is actually from the Slammys. And then, of course, you think of the shows in 96 and 97 when they brought it back and they had Todd Pettengill do those opening songs that actually were pretty good if you go back and listen to them. But they're calling the 2024 Slammys the Fans' Choice Awards. And they have released the categories for fan voting. You can vote right now at WWE.com/Slammys. Voting ends this Wednesday, March 27th. I'm going to read these categories and I'm going to give you my vote for each one. So they have a Female Superstar of the Year category, and the nominees are Rhea Ripley, Bianca Belair, Bayley, Io Sky, and Becky Lynch. And I had to really think about this, because my first instinct was to go with Rhea Ripley. I thought about Io, but my first instinct was to go with Rhea Ripley, because she's pushed as one of the top names in the entire company, and she's obviously very over, and she's part of... certainly one of the top heel factions in the entire company. It's either that or the Bloodline. And since the Bloodline was really started to lose a lot of steam, I thought late last year, the Judgment Day became the de facto top heel group in the company. But I stopped short of going with Rhea, And I'm actually going to go with Becky Lynch on this. And the reason I'm going to go with Becky Lynch on this is because I was thinking Rhea Ripley beat Charlotte Flair at WrestleMania last year. She's been champion almost a full year. In that time, it's hard for me to really think about how many great, memorable title defenses that Rhea Ripley has had. And we don't even see her in the ring very often to begin with, even on TV, right? It's very rare that we see Rhea Ripley in the ring. She doesn't have a whole lot to work with on that Raw roster right now. There aren't very many women on the Raw women's roster who I think can credibly and believably get in the ring and challenge Rhea. You've got Becky, you've got Nia. And honestly, after that, the well pretty much runs dry. But she has not had a lot of memorable title defenses in this run. In fact, a lot of them have been very lame and just kind of underwhelming. This has been a very forgettable title run if you just judge it based on the quality of the matches and the feuds and the programs that this woman has had. I look at Becky Lynch and going back to the summer and going back to that cage match with her and Trish, and look, the feud with her and Trish and watching it play out on television was horrible. The creative for that feud was terrible, but the cage match at Payback was excellent. And then Becky went on to have a great match at Extreme Rules, the NXT show. It was an Extreme Rules match at the NXT show against Tiffany Stratton. That was at the end of September. Becky had a few other really good matches. I look back at the very first Raw of this year. Her and Nia Jax on day one actually had a pretty good match. And then Becky and Nia just had what I thought was an excellent last woman standing match on TV on Monday. Becky has put the work in. And her body of work, certainly over the last 6 months or so, has been far better and far more memorable than anything they have had Rhea Ripley doing. I cannot sit here and call Rhea Ripley the female superstar of the year because the matches have to mean something. And that body of work just isn't there. So I would go with Becky. I would go with Becky or Rio, frankly, over Rhea. But I'm going to go with Becky Lynch. Male superstar of the year. And when, by the way, when they say superstar of the year, they're not counting, this is not just 2023. I guess it looks like the cutoff is March of last year to March of this year. So that's the year they're talking about. But they have male superstar of the year, Cody Rhodes, Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, Gunther, Logan Paul. Easy one for me. Male superstar of the year, Cody Rhodes. Just based on the way that they have used him and positioned him as that top face on that Raw roster. The fact that he's been around for longer than Roman Reigns has, so he has a bigger body of work. The things that they've had him doing, winning the Royal Rumble back-to-back years, all of these things. Male superstar of the year to me, it's a slam dunk, Cody Rhodes. Best entrance, Cody Rhodes, Roman Reigns, Bianca Belair, Seth Rollins, Rhea Ripley, Becky Lynch, The Rock, or Dominic Mysterio at WrestleMania 39. When he came out of the back of the paddy wagon and he had the Lucha mask on and they led him to the ring in handcuffs. I got to go with The Rock. Say what you want to, but the fact is that The Rock comes out there and there is nobody in the company right now, especially that new entrance he has with the music blend where it kind of fades out of the current song into the Hollywood Rock remix and the lightning bolts and everything. Rock's got the best entrance in the company. I'm actually looking forward to seeing what his entrance is going to be at WrestleMania. I mentioned this, I think, on the Raw stream, it might have been. I might have mentioned this on Monday, but I said, you know, they already went and they gave the Hollywood Rock theme and he comes out with the lightning and everything else, looking like Black Adam. But if you think back to the original Hollywood Rock entrance in 2003, they had the helicopter and the Tron. I could see them doing something at WrestleMania this year where Rock actually shows up in a helicopter. And they follow him from the helipad into the building, and then they hit the music and out he comes. Like, I can't imagine that this being his first real match in so many years, and him being in the main event of WrestleMania that first night, they're not just going to have The Rock walk out there for a regular entrance. Like, they're going to have something planned. And it could end up being a goated entrance because I'm sure they're going to go all out for it. But right now, best entrance, I got to go Rock on that. Return of the year, CM Punk, The Rock, Nia Jax, Randy Orton, or Naomi. It's either Punk or Rock, and I got to go with CM Punk because it's just of how they pulled that off, it being such a big surprise, hitting the music, right? They were there. They were in Chicago, right? They were in Chicago that night. It's one of those never thought it would happen, right? Never thought I would see the day type of situations, the reaction he got. It can't be anything other than CM Punk. That includes The Rock. So Punk wins for Return of the Year, if I'm voting. Faction of the Year, Judgment Day, Alpha Academy, Imperium, Bloodline, Damage Control. My vote would go with the Judgment Day. The Judgment Day has become the top heel group in the company. They have, I think, for at least the last half year, they have really taken over that Raw brand. Things sort of jumped the shark there for a while with the Bloodline, and frankly, I still kind of feel that way. The Rock has at least injected some new life into it because now they have so many different directions they can go with it. And maybe they'll add new members, but the Judgment Day would be the faction of the year. Yeah, they've got the tag team titles. Rhea has the women's title. Dominic had the North American title for a while. They added a new member in JD McDonagh. They've got this stuff going on with R-Truth. Everybody loves R-Truth. So you got to go with the Judgment Day. Rivalry of the year. Seth Rollins against Drew McIntyre. Dirty Dominic Mysterio against Rey Mysterio. Bianca Belair against Damage Control. Roman Reigns against Cody Rhodes. R-Truth against the Judgment Day. I voted for Dirty Dom and his deadbeat dad as the rivalry of the year. I thought that was built very well. And I loved the match they had at WrestleMania last year. I thought it was a lot of fun. And I look at the rest of the options on this list, and none of them scream rivalry of the year. I mean, there were aspects to some of them that were enjoyable, but I don't think I enjoyed any of them as much as I did Dom and Ray. And you know, Roman and Cody, can you really even call that rivalry of the year? There wasn't much of a rivalry. I mean, Cody won the Rumble and they built to WrestleMania. It's kind of like the build now to WrestleMania this year. There's not a whole lot going on between Cody and Roman. Right now, it's all about Rock. And then they threw Seth in there. And the focus is really primarily on the tag match on night one. Where's the rivalry? I'm failing to see where the rivalry is between these two men. And it was the same thing last year. So I got to go Dom and Ray on that. NXT Superstar of the Year, Ilya Dragunov, Carmelo Hayes, Lyra Valkyria, Tiffany Stratton, or Bron Breakker. Bron Breakker, he should not have even been in NXT for the majority of last year. He should have been called up, you know, long before he was. So they had him kind of milling around and doing different things. He wasn't the NXT Superstar of the Year. Carmelo Hayes was my NXT Superstar of the Year. Match of the Year. Bad Bunny against Damian Priest in the San Juan Street Fight at Backlash. Roman Reigns against Sami Zayn at the Elimination Chamber. Gunther against Chad Gable on Raw. That was the, I think, Labor Day episode of Raw. Asuka, not Asuka, against Bianca Belair against Charlotte Flair at SummerSlam in a triple threat. And Charlotte Flair against Rhea Ripley at WrestleMania 39. This, for me, really boils down to two matches. My top WWE match, if you remember the countdown I did, the end of last year, my top WWE match for 2023 was it's not even on here, it was the triple threat at WrestleMania for the Intercontinental title with Gunther, Sheamus, and Drew McIntyre. I don't know how they left that off the list here, but it's not even on here. If it was on here, I would go with that. But I did have that San Juan Street fight on my list at number 8 between Damian Priest and Bad Bunny. I had Charlotte and Rhea at number 11. That was an excellent match. But I had more fun watching that street fight than I ever thought I would. I'm actually going to go with the San Juan Street Fight. I'm going to go with Bad Bunny against Damian Priest. I am picking the Bad Bunny match as the match of the year in WWE. Well, not something I would have told you I'd be doing if you told me this a year ago, but here we are. I just got to be honest. That's just the match I had more fun with. The OMG moment of the year. They have Rey Mysterio punches Dominic on SmackDown. They have CM Punk returns to WWE at Survivor Series. Io Sky cashes in Money in the Bank at SummerSlam. The Rock slaps Cody Rhodes at the WrestleMania 40 press conference. Damage Control turns on Bayley, and Cody Rhodes slaps The Rock on the March 8th episode of SmackDown. Give me a break. Oh yeah, it's the OMG moment of the year. I mean, I'm looking at this list. There's only one option. How is this even a contest? The answer is CM Punk returning at Survivor Series. That is the OMG moment of the year. The social star of the year, I don't really give a shit, but the nominees are Grayson Waller, Logan Paul, Drew McIntyre, Chelsea Green, and Liv Morgan. I just realized I don't follow any of these people on social media. Actually, that's not true. I follow Liv. Liv follows me, I follow Liv. But I don't follow any of these other people. I'll go with Logan Paul. Logan Paul is the social star of the year. He's very good at that. And finally, the breakout superstar of the year. I actually thought this was the hardest one to decide on. Breakout star of the year, Jey Uso, Tiffany Stratton, Pretty Deadly, Dragon Lee, or LA Knight. And this was the toughest one for me. It was between LA Knight and Jey Uso. Now, Jey Uso has become a legit top name in this company. He gets top star reactions. He sells top star level merch, puts up very impressive numbers. I'm going with LA Knight, though. I got LA Knight as the breakout star because you got to think about it like this. Before 2023 started, Jey Uso was still a very important player in the Bloodline story. LA Knight was the manager of an undercard comedy team, and I assure you, he was headed for the unemployment line. It was a far more dramatic transformation for him in 2023 than it was for Jey Uso. And like Jey, he wound up wrestling Roman Reigns for the title, only to be screwed out of it by the Bloodline. Now, they both broke out in a big way last year, but in LA Knight, they ended up with a star that they didn't have before. So, because of that, I thought his breakout was more dramatic than Jey's. And those are your Slammy categories. Again, you can vote. You have until Wednesday to vote, and then they'll stream it on social media on WrestleMania Sunday. It's not like the Slammies of old, but at least they brought it back. Some other quick notes here. WWE announced a new Peacock documentary called Bray Wyatt Becoming Immortal that will debut on April 1st. And I thought that maybe they were going to save the announcement of him going into the Hall of Fame for the day that the documentary drops. Meltzer had a note this week saying that apparently they've decided not to induct Bray Wyatt into the Hall of Fame this year. They're going to save that for another year. And so I guess we'll wait and see. I'm going to wait until the day the documentary drops. I still think there may be a chance of the announcement coming on that day. But that's the latest on his Hall of Fame status. Undertaker is going to be doing the narration for the documentary. You know, just watching the 60-second trailer that they put out for it was very emotional. And so if the trailer was emotional and watching Mike Rotunda break down in tears talking about his son was emotional, I am sure the entire thing is going to be very rough to watch. I don't know if it's going to be 60 minutes, 90 minutes, 2 hours. I don't know what the runtime is, but I will definitely be watching that when it drops. And I'm sure that's not going to be a fun watch. Three new matches have been added to tomorrow's Raw from Chicago, where CM Punk will be making his return. He has said that he will be at WrestleMania in some capacity, and so we'll see if he gets announced for some kind of role in the World Heavyweight title match on night two between Seth Rollins and Drew McIntyre. Do they make him a referee? Does he do commentary? Is he going to host WrestleMania? Are they going to bring him in for the kickoff show? I'm sure he'll shed some light on that tomorrow night. But in addition to that, Adam Pearce has announced that Andrade will wrestle Ivar, Shinsuke Nakamura will face Jey Uso, and Sami Zayn will face Bronson Reed. And that is the lineup as it stands for tomorrow night. Now, they had previously announced that Andrade, they had a segment on the show last week where the Judgment Day mentioned that Andrade would be in action this week. We didn't know against who. They've been courting him. They're scouting him. And they're teasing the possibility that he may end up joining the Judgment Day. And so you fast forward to SmackDown on Friday night, Rey Mysterio had a match with Santos Escobar, and they had a full match. And Dominic got involved. He caused a distraction, which led to Escobar winning. And now it looks like they're gearing up for a tag team match. And I thought that Rey and Dragon Lee would make a lot more sense than Rey and Carlito, because some people were saying Carlito. I said, no, that's not the match. You know, Dragon Lee is someone who they, at least for a while, they were pushing. They've definitely cooled him off. And so I thought that would be the match. And I was thinking of it in terms of it being a SmackDown match. Like, the thought of Andrade never even occurred to me, but it would make sense because Dominic is a Raw star. So if you're going to have Dominic tagging with Escobar, then it absolutely would make sense to have Rey teaming with Andrade. And we'll come to find out that Andrade, of course, is not going to join the Judgment Day. So I think that's the play for WrestleMania. I think it's going to be Rey and Andrade teaming up to take on Escobar and Dominik. The other thing from SmackDown on Friday night, the whole show was built around a face-to-face between Roman Reigns and Cody Rhodes, which I was looking forward to because we get a break from The Rock. Everything has been about The Rock. Everything's been about The Rock against Cody, The Rock against Cody's mom, The Rock against Cody's dog. And so for a while, on Friday, we had a little breather from The Rock, and we got back to the actual main event on night two, the focus on Roman Reigns against Cody Rhodes for the Undisputed title. They went out there at the end of the show, and they had a whole lot of nothing that they said. Roman didn't really have much new to say. Cody didn't have much new to say. Cody put his hand out to shake Roman's hand at the end of all of it because, you know, Roman, of course, has been insulting this man and insulting his family and his story and his legacy. So what do? You put your hand out like a good little baby face to shake his hand, which Roman wouldn't do. Even Roman looked at him like, what the fuck is up with this guy? You want to shake my hand after the shit that I've talked about you? So he left the ring. As it turned out, he lied because Roman said that I will come alone and will not bring any other member of the bloodline except Paul Heyman, who is no physical threat. I will come alone if you come alone. And they both at the beginning said that they were there by themselves. As it turned out, that was a lie. Jimmy Uso came out of the crowd. Solo Sikoa came out of the crowd. But Cody had a surprise because Jey Uso was there and Seth Rollins was there. So they both lied to each other and we had a standoff with everybody at the very end of the show. But when it was over, it just felt completely and utterly underwhelming. For what may well end up being the final time that we see these two men in the ring together face to face before WrestleMania Sunday. And they'll be in the ring on WrestleMania Saturday. But this could be it. Like, we're looking ahead to Raw next week and SmackDown. We don't know if Cody and Roman are going to do anything else on the show. If they're going to have a contract signing, if they're going to have another face-to-face, if there's going to be a pull-apart. We don't know. You know, they didn't get physical last year. I don't expect them to this year until Mania itself. But, you know, whether it's throwing in a new wrinkle into the story or bringing up some other aspect, something. There was nothing new. Roman is out there and Cody is saying, hey, you're talking about me and whether I can trust Seth Rollins. Can you trust The Rock? And so the entire segment wasn't even about the title. It wasn't even about night two. It was still focused on The Rock and the tag team match on night one. And it really hit me when the segment was over. My excitement level for that night two main event is not where it should be. And that's a problem because you're building to a big championship match where Cody may well end up winning the title. He better win the title. I mean, Cody doesn't win the title. I mean, forget it. It's over. But at some point here, you've got to shift the focus on the title. The title has been in this man's possession for 3.5 years. Now, whatever happens on night one is going to lead directly into night two. I get that. Night one is very important. But it just seems like they just can't quit The Rock. And everything has this shadow over it, whether he's there in the flesh or not. And he may not be back on any of the shows until April 1st. He's going to be at that Raw show at the Barclays Center, and that may be the last time we see Rock on TV before Mania. But man, when that segment was over, I said, this is what they built the entire show around. This is what they built the entire week to. This big face-to-face between these two men. This is the WrestleMania main event. Didn't feel like it. When that segment was over, didn't feel like it. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. What I wouldn't give for an extra hour in my day. It would be an extra hour to get some work done, to get some sleep, or get some work done while I sleep. All right, so I guess it doesn't work that way. A lot of us wish that we had more time in our lives, but we don't. So how do you make use of that time that you do have? You need to know what's most important to you and make it a priority. Therapy can help you figure out what matters most to you so you can do more of it. Therapy can be helpful to you in a whole lot of different ways. It can teach you important coping skills. It can help you overcome certain insecurities that you may have about yourself. It can help you better understand your own feelings. And that's just a few. Therapy is not just for people who may have experienced a trauma of some sort in their lives, but it can help you there too if you have been through anything like that. So if you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's all online. It's designed to be convenient and fit into your schedule, regardless of how busy you may be. All you need to do to get started is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And even better, you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. See? I told you it was convenient. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Solomonster today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Solomonster. On Dynamite Wednesday night, Adam Copeland beat Christian Cage to win back the TNT Championship in their I Quit match in Toronto, which was the highlight of the show. And Copeland has already said that he will be continuing his open challenge, his Cope Open, as he calls it, and defending the title that way. So a la John Cena with the U.S. title. Daniel Garcia was out there at the end of the match because he and Matt Menard had come out to fight off Killswitch and Nick Wayne. And it was very clear the way that Garcia, you know, he put the title over Copeland's shoulder and the way he was looking at him and eyeballing him that we're going to get a Copeland-Daniel Garcia match at some point. I don't know if it'll be a Dynasty. I don't know if it'll be a Double or Nothing. I would think, though, that the goal here would be to try to elevate Daniel Garcia to that next level by giving him a big win over a name like Copeland and putting the TNT title on him at some point. Now, someone emailed me and suggested, well, maybe Jon Moxley will challenge Copeland for the championship at Dynasty. I still think, my thought process on this hasn't changed. I still think that Moxley is going to take that IWGP title from Tetsuya Naito next month at their Windy City Riot show. I feel like they're going to shake things up a little bit. They're going to put the belt on Moxley. New Japan just announced its resurgence show for May 11th in Southern California, and the IWGP title is going to be defended there. I could see Moxley holding it through Forbidden Door in June and maybe dropping it there, you know, kind of give him a short run with it. So he's going to be occupied with things other than the TNT title. And plus, I think it would be a bad look anyway to go from Christian Cage to Adam Copeland to Jon Moxley challenging for the TNT title. The purpose now of that championship should be to elevate someone who is right there on the borderline, but they're not quite there yet, but they're almost there. It's not to constantly have more established names challenging for the belt, or just having ex-WWE guys challenging for the belt. At some point, they have to get away from that and get back to putting the belt on someone like a Darby Allin, like they did with Darby on two different times, or Wardlow, or in this case, Garcia, or whoever it might be. Doesn't even have to be Daniel Garcia. I would love to see Powerhouse Hobbs get the belt back, right? Didn't he have it for a very brief period of time? It was so brief, I can't even remember fully, but I think he had it. I think he beat Wardlow for it. But anyway, yes, Jon Moxley is not the answer. Okada is the new Continental Champion, which should be surprising to absolutely no one. The minute they announced that match with him and Eddie Kingston for Dynamite this week, you can't beat Okada. Not yet. So there's no more Triple Crown, because it was only for the Continental title. So Eddie is still the Ring of Honor World Champion. He is still the New Japan Strong Openweight Champion. But as per the rules and the way it'll be going forward now, it is strictly just the Continental title, and that means every one of these matches is contested under Continental rules, which means no outside interference. Pac came out after the match, literally just came out, and walked right to the back. So I guess that was his way of planting his flag and saying that he is next in line. So they'll probably be doing Okada and Pac at Dynasty for the Continental title. And look, I think it's something great for Okada now to go around with this championship and beat some people until Kenny Omega is ready to come back, and whenever that is. And hopefully, you know, ideally it would be in time for Wembley in August, but there's no telling when he'll be able to come back. When he is, Okada will be there waiting for him, and they can do the inevitable Omega-Okada match for the Continental title. But I mean, as far as how this is going to work, Tony Khan said that the way it's going to work, every year, when they do the Continental Classic, which is going to come back, it is going to become an annual thing, whoever the champion is will be in the tournament automatically, and they will have to win the tournament to retain their title. And I've seen language used where, okay, the title is vacated, but then in the same breath, it says the champion will have to win the tournament to retain. right? Retaining and vacating are two different things. I don't know if the title is formally vacated or not, but it would essentially, you know, be on the line in the tournament. You'd have to go through everybody in this round robin and go to the finals and win to hold on to the title. And I still think it's very silly that they even added another new championship. You know, we have the AEW World title, we have the TNT title, we have the International title, we have the Tag Team titles, we have the Trios titles, we have the Women's title, we have the TBS title, we have the FTW title, which isn't really an officially recognized title, but they have it anyway. We see Ring of Honor titles defended on AEW television, right? So, there's so many titles to begin with, and I just feel like if you are going to have a round-robin tournament like that in the vein of a G1 climax, there's a reason why the winner of the G1, after a grueling month of matches, is then gifted a world title opportunity in the main event of their biggest show of the year. They get a briefcase that affords them the opportunity to go to the Tokyo Dome and challenge for the IWGP heavyweight title. That makes sense to me. What doesn't make so much sense to me is having something similar. And the matches were fantastic in the Continental Classic. So you're going to have a month or so of these grueling matches in these two blocks, and then you're going to go to the finals. And when you win, you want to feel like, man, this person really earned this, right? But what do they earn? Well, they win the Continental title. Yeah, but who cares about the Continental title? That person should win the opportunity to challenge for the AEW World Heavyweight title. So you do the Continental Classic in December, and you crown this new champion, and then you turn around at the beginning of March, and you have a randomly announced scramble match at Revolution with the winner getting an AEW World Heavyweight Championship match. That's how Wardlow got the shot against Samoa Joe. He went in there, and on one night, he won a scramble match. And then 2 weeks later, he's on television challenging for the title. How do you reconcile this? I mean, if I had gone through the rigors of a Continental Classic and had to go through all of these different people and all of these top names in this grueling tournament, and all I had to show for it was this shitty belt, and this guy in one night is going to earn himself the right to challenge for the world title, I'd be a little pissed about that. But this is how they've decided to do things. And don't even get me started on Wardlow. Don't even get me started on him. Goes in there against Samoa Joe after that fiery promo that he cut weeks before. He put everybody on notice. The best promo of his career. More fire in this man's belly than I've ever seen before. He wins the scramble match. He earns himself a world title match. He goes to big business and he loses. He gets put to sleep by Samoa Joe. So too, his career was put to sleep. And then, this week on Dynamite, Adam Cole says that Wardlow had one job and he failed. Which is true. He had one job, he couldn't get the job done. His only job as part of the Undisputed Kingdom was to win the world title and give it to Adam Cole, and he couldn't even do that. And now his new job is to simply make sure that the other people who are champions keep their belts. Make sure that Roddy keeps his international title. Make sure that Taven and Bennett keep their tag team titles. That's his only job now. This is what he's been reduced to. Now Wardlow is right back in the same position that he was in when he was in the Pinnacle. And eventually MJF is going to come back and we'll probably get him and Wardlow as, you know, unlikely allies against the Undisputed Kingdom. I can see it now. I can see where this is probably going to go. And I don't see how this changes the trajectory of this man's career at all. At all. Because if that happens, the focus is still going to be on MJF and him getting his revenge and an eventual match with Adam Cole. How does this help Wardlow? If that is the direction that they're going to go in, by turning him babyface, he splits away and maybe he aligns with MJF again. How does that benefit Wardlow? I still cannot come up with a decent answer to that question. The only answer I can come up with as far as what next for Wardlow is whenever his contract is up. And then he can go try his chances somewhere else and take his efforts and his talents somewhere else. New surroundings, new opponents, new creative, fresh coat of paint. At least he'll have a shot. Because in this company, he's got none. But it was not a good night to be a champion in AEW or Ring of Honor on Wednesday. Unless you're Julia Hart. Then it was a pretty good night. Eddie Kingston got beat. Christian Cage got beat. Tony Storm ate the pin from Thunder Rosa in a tag team match. Kyle Fletcher is the Ring of Honor television champion. He took the losing fall in a tag team match on Rampage that night. Now, Hook did beat Chris Jericho, but again, the FTW title does not count. It is not officially recognized. Only Julia Hart, the TBS champion, came out a winner, with Sky Blue over Chris Statlander and Willow Nightingale in the main event on Rampage. Rampage aired live because it was bumped from Friday because of the NCAA stuff, March Madness. And honestly, the four women went out there and they ended up having a hell of a street fight there at the end of the night. Mercedes was on the show and Will Ospreay was on the show. They each cut promos. Ospreay's promo far better than the one Mercedes cut. Mercedes didn't have a whole lot new to say. Ospreay, you can see he's getting better at this. And he's out there and he is just all pumped up and he's got the crowd pumped up and he's going into Dynasty to wrestle Bryan Danielson. That's obviously going to be fantastic. So Ospreay, you know, every week he seems to get more comfortable. He seems to get better at this. Mercedes, this was only her second week on the show, her second promo. We'll give it time and see. I was not impressed by her promo segment on Wednesday. I'm still waiting just to get her back in the ring. It's going to be a year soon since this woman wrestled the match. I'm waiting to see her get back in the ring and start mixing it up with people like Willow and like Chris Statlander and Britt Baker when she eventually comes back and Thunder Rosa and Toni Storm and all of these different people. That's what I'm waiting for. Now, Tony Khan, in an interview with Comic Book Nation, said this about a possible AEW Hall of Fame. He admitted that he has not thought about doing any sort of Hall of Fame because AEW is still a very young company. But with that being said, he said that he does have some ideas on who would be the first inductees. He said the first two people that come to mind I think we would have to honor would be Sting and Mr. Brody Lee. He said two of the greatest champions and two of the greatest people that we have ever had in AEW. Very different circumstances, but I think those would be the first two people that come to mind. Also, somebody that never got to wrestle in AEW that I also feel very strongly about who needs to be talked about and honored is Jay Briscoe. Now, I have no issue with any of those names that he mentions. Sting would absolutely belong in there. Brody Lee would have his place in there. And if he wants to honor the Briscoes and he wants to honor Jay Briscoe, again, you get no argument out of me. I think that's all great. As far as who else would be potentially in a first class of inductees into any future AEW Hall of Fame, Chris Jericho and Kenny Omega would be a given. Because without them and the match they had at the Tokyo Dome on that Wrestle Kingdom, who knows if there even is an AEW right now. Jon Moxley and Bryan Danielson are two obvious ones. Cody should be in there. But Dustin Rhodes should definitely go in. But all of this Hall of Fame talk is very premature. I mean, 5 years from now, they're going to be 10 years old. I think then you can start talking about a potential Hall of Fame. And one of the greatest tag teams of the last 20 years are about to hit the free agent market. PW Insider broke the news that the TNA contracts for Alex Shelley and Chris Sabin, the Motor City Machine Guns, are due to expire at the end of the month. The TNA roster held an emotional send-off for them backstage at their taping in Philadelphia last night. Their final TV appearance is set to air next month, challenging Eddie Edwards and Brian Myers for the TNA Tag Team titles. Gee, I wonder who wins. Shelley recently filed for trademarks on both the Motor City Machine Guns name and on the initials MCMG, both for entertainment and merchandising purposes. Killer Kelly is also gone from TNA. She is said to have finished up with them earlier this month at their Sacrifice pay-per-view. So that's two departures less than 2 months after they fired Scott D'Amore. And D'Amore was very close with the Guns. I don't know how close he was with Killer Kelly, but he was very close with the Guns, had a hand in training both of them. I don't know if that was their only consideration in leaving, how much that may have played into their decision. But you have to think it may have played a role in their decision-making. The D'Amore thing was just a total self-own on TNA's part, a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And it could potentially cost them more talent when their deals come due. You know, Shelley and Sabin are two of the most decorated champions in TNA history. They're both former TNA world champions. Shelley lost the title in January to Moose. Sabin recently dropped the X Division title to Mustafa Ali last month. these two are TNA originals through and through. They've been very loyal to that company for a very long time. Last March, they announced they had signed a new deal to stay with TNA. Now we know that it was only a one-year deal. But they've been keeping very busy on the independent scene. We've had Shelley in for House of Glory recently. He'll be at our Philadelphia show representing Wrestling Revolver as its champion, defending against our champion, Mike Santana, title for title. He and Sabin have been working other shows together as the Machine Guns. It goes without saying what an asset they would be to the tag team division in WWE or in AEW. Now, they feel like they would be a better fit for AEW. You know, you put them in there with teams like the Bucks and FTR and the Lucha Bros and Top Flight. But Tony Khan has signed enough people for now. He signed a lot of names. I would love to see them give the tag team division in WWE a boost. You know, that division feels renewed recently. You know, adding these two would only make it better because they make everybody they're in the ring with better. So imagine the Machine Guns in there with the New Day, the Machine Guns in there with Imperium, the Machine Guns in there with anybody. You know, Balor and Priest, anybody in that tag team division. Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate. Legado del Fantasma, the LWO, so on and so forth. I think they have a lot to offer. Now, they could also end up being, you know, in a situation where WWE wants to bring them in and put them in NXT. I don't want to see that. Shelley worked a handful of matches in NXT with Kushida when they were the Time Splitters. This 4 years ago, they got back together, and it was like two matches, and it was cool, and I didn't know if it was going to lead to any more than that, but that was pretty much the end of that. Sabin has never worked for WWE. I would want them to have the chance to work main roster talent if they went to WWE, but it all boils down to how much interest they get. If you have the chance to sign the Motor City Machine Guns, if you are Paul Levesque, if you are Tony Khan, and this opportunity presents itself, you would be a fool not to make them an offer. Wherever they end up going, I hope they get paid. I don't know exactly what they were making in TNA, but I'm sure they were not getting paid in the way that they would be if they landed in WWE or in AEW, and those guys deserve to get paid. This week's Dark Side of the Ring covered the late Terry Gordy. The final flight of the Freebird is what they called this episode, and one of the greatest big men in the history of the business who probably does not get talked about enough. You know, he's something of a forgotten figure in today's wrestling world. People know him as part of the Fabulous Freebirds, but it was really the tale of two careers with Gordy, you know, one with the Freebirds and then another in Japan and as part of a tag team with the late Dr. Death Steve Williams. But he was only 32 when he overdosed and suffered permanent brain damage that cut his career short. I mean, he still wrestled after that, but he was never the same. And he was only 40 years old when he passed away in 2001. I thought the episode did a good job of balancing Terry Gordy the talent and Terry Gordy the family man with Terry Gordy the party animal, who did things to excess. As a lot of people did in the wrestling business back then. Maybe Gordy more than most, and unfortunately a lot of those people are no longer around anymore to talk about it. But in the end, it cost him everything. Not exactly a story we haven't heard before in this series, but Gordy does not come across as a bully or someone who abused people or had a lot of enemies. He was his own worst enemy. He and Michael Hayes were inseparable. They weren't just tag team partners, they were like brothers. And Michael, being a part of WWE, was obviously not going to be interviewed for this, but he did tweet that he watched the episode and he was pleased with how accurate it was. Shane Helms would have a different opinion of the Buff Bagwell episode. But if anybody knew Gordy, it was Michael Hayes. And if he says the episode was accurate or mostly accurate, then it must be pretty damn accurate. Hayes' absence was noticeable here, though, because, like I said, nobody was closer with Gordy than he was. And he could have added insight to this that was missing. But as talking heads go, they had two of Gordy's kids, his son Ray, who played Jesse of Jesse and Festus fame on SmackDown many years ago, and his daughter Miranda, who is also a wrestler. She wrestles independently. He has another daughter, Amber, who was never mentioned. They spoke with his nephew, Richard, who also was a wrestler. They spoke with Jimmy Garvin, who became officially part of the Fabulous Freebirds. I think it was in 89. I know it was in the late 80s that he officially joined with them, although I know before that, when Gordy was over in Japan, he would come back and forth. Garvin would fill in for him, but he became an official member of the Freebirds later on. But it's Mick Foley and Jim Cornette who I thought shined the most and really added to the episode. If you were looking for anything about his upbringing, they gave us next to nothing. I can tell you he got his start early, and when I say early, he had his first wrestling match at 13 years old. By 18, he was headlining at the Superdome. I always thought Rey Mysterio started earlier than almost anyone, but Gordy got him beat. He dropped out of school in the ninth grade to become a wrestler. It's all he ever wanted to do. And he had a natural gift for it. Everybody in the episode spoke glowingly about his ability. You could see it just by watching his matches. Pretty early into the episode, they were already talking about Terry meeting Michael Hayes for the first time in Mississippi. And Michael was a fan of Lynyrd Skynyrd, as a lot of people were back then, and he was the one who pitched the idea of calling their team the Freebirds, and they started coming out to the song, which Cornette said was not a common thing at the time to have entrance music, and it wasn't. They were the first to really popularize it. Now, in the past, you know, Sergeant Slaughter has claimed that he used to come out, which he did, he used to come out to the Marine Corps hymn in the 70s. So different people at different times have sort of taken credit for ushering in the era of entrance music in wrestling, but Gorgeous George was coming out to Pomp and Circumstance back in the 50s. So George would have them all beat, and he may not have even been the first to do it. I think there was somebody else before him. So it goes back a lot longer than just the Freebirds. Buddy Roberts was later added to make the Freebirds a trio, and they quickly glossed over their legendary feud with the Von Erichs in World Class, and they had comments from Kevin Von Erich in the episode, and David Manning, who was the booker and the promoter and the referee, or a referee, in World Class. They said the promotion caught fire with the Birds and the Von Erichs feud, and it did. And it all stemmed from one of the most famous angles in wrestling history, and they never even mentioned it. So I will. It was their Christmas Star Wars show in 1982. Watching the episode, you would never know that when the Freebirds came into World Class, they were babyfaces. Because they just sort of mentioned them, this great feud they had with the Von Erichs. The Von Erichs were the heroes, and the Freebirds were the evil heels. But when they first came in to the territory, they were babyfaces. That way the heel turn would mean more when it eventually came. And on Christmas night, 1982, they were supposed to team with Buddy Roberts to challenge for the inaugural six-man tag team titles. When Buddy couldn't make it, David Von Erich took his place as a substitute. They won the titles, and then David graciously surrendered his title for Buddy to take when he got there. But then later that same night is when Kerry wrestled Ric Flair in a cage for the NWA World Heavyweight title. Michael Hayes was the guest enforcer, the guest referee. They chose him because Flair had a reputation for winning his matches with some controversial means, and they knew that Hayes wouldn't take crap from anybody, so he was the special referee. When Flair and Kerry both got knocked out, Hayes put Kerry on top of Rick for the three count, but Kerry didn't want to win the title that way. And so the two of them argued, and Hayes went to go leave. Flair shoves Kerry into Hayes, knocks him out of the cage. When Hayes turns around, he only sees Kerry. And he didn't know that it was Ric Flair who caused the shove. And that's when Terry Gordy on the outside slams the cage door on Kerry's head. And that's what ignited the feud between the Freebirds and the Von Erichs that set the entire territory on fire. You know, on the Tales from the Territories episode that they did on World Class, they talked about Gordy slamming the cage door on Kerry's head so hard that it left an indent in his skull, which is why Kerry was bleeding so much. If you ever watch the actual footage of what happened, you can clearly see Kerry blading himself. I mean, the other story is cool. It makes Gordy sound more badass, I guess, but that's not exactly what happened. So they very briefly mentioned the Freebirds' time in WWE. And the reason that it was briefly mentioned is because it was a very brief run, and there really wasn't much to talk about. Jimmy Garvin said that Terry was hungover and fell asleep in a meeting with Vince McMahon, which did not go over very well, and then they flamed out quickly. And that was really the extent of it. And they had a little bit of footage from one of their WWF matches. I think it might have been from the Philadelphia Spectrum. But that was the extent to which they covered it. And by the way, that is a true story, according to Michael Hayes. He did doze off in a meeting with Vince McMahon. I don't know that it was their first meeting, but he did, as he says, he took a nap. Maybe it wasn't the right time. He goes, everybody takes a nap. Maybe that was the wrong time to do it. So that is true. But there is also a very long-told story that Andre the Giant got the Freebirds fired. Andre did not get the Freebirds fired. And what happened, in the words of Michael Hayes himself, because he's told this story before, is that Vince McMahon wanted him. He did not necessarily want Buddy Roberts or Terry Gordy, even though they did come in with him. But Vince really wanted Michael. Plus, Hayes says Terry met the love of his life, and Gordy didn't really want to leave Texas. So his heart wasn't really into going to New York in the first place. One night, they show up. They're outside some high school. This story, you're talking about 1980s wrestling. This story could go a lot of bad ways. But no, they were in front of a high school because there was a show there that night. Michael says, why are we here? They're like, well, we're working tonight. And this was news to Michael because he thought they had the night off. So he had been drinking. He had been taking pills. Now they're telling him we got to work. Well, it just so happens that Andre was working as the agent for the show that night. And they walk in, and Andre's in the back. He's playing cards. Andre looks up, and he points at Michael Hayes, and he goes, he's drunk. And Buddy and Terry, they try to stick up for their friend. They're like, no, he's not. As soon as they let go of him, Hayes falls down drunk on the floor. So Andre is upset because, you know, he put a good word in for these guys to get them the gig in the first place. And as it turned out, Andre never did stooge him off to management. He never did call in and say, hey, you know, this guy was drunk, you should get rid of him. Hayes says he called Vince McMahon himself and stooged himself off over what happened. Maybe he thought that, you know, he would beat them to the punch. I don't know. But he called Vince and told him what happened and, you know, apologized for it. Even then, he wasn't fired. He was fired later on. They were on their way to Japan. They were leaving for a flight to Japan. They had a booking there that Vince knew about when he first brought them in. And they had that commitment. They were about to fly out. And he got a call from George Scott, who was booking for Vince at the time. And George Scott is the one who told him, look, Vince, he doesn't trust you. He doesn't think he can rely on you, so he's letting you go. And that was the end of the Freebirds in WWE. They lasted all of 5 months. Gordy, after this, made his way over to Japan for the first time. He became the next... And when I say the first time, this is when he really started to catch fire as a singles heel over there. He became the next American monster in the same vein of a Bruiser Brody or a Stan Hansen. And he had great success working there. The problem is, it took a toll on him physically. You know, the travel, that harder style. And Cornette said that Gordy, he tore both of his ACLs, kept on working. Eventually, he had to get double knee surgery, and he was told by his doctor, look, you got to lose weight, because he was a big guy. He was over 300 pounds, and so he reached out to Richard Simmons, and he was able to slim down to 265 pounds. Terry Gordy contacting Richard Simmons is not the turn of events that I was expecting. Wow. How about Richard Simmons managing Terry Gordy? Holy shit, that would have been amazing. Nice little heel duo. Richard Simmons comes out, he'd get easy heat. God, imagine him managing Terry Gordy. So Gordy became the first American to win the All Japan Triple Crown. They talked about his 1991 match with Mitsuharu Misawa, which may be the greatest singles match of his career. It's hard for me to say because I don't have the familiarity with his work, especially his singles work, that other people might who are either a little bit older than I am, or maybe they were watching World Class and they were watching the NWA, they were watching these different places that he landed. Maybe they were tape trading, you know, for Japanese stuff. I wasn't doing any of that. It's hard for me to sit here and say, here are the top five or top 10 Terry Gordy matches. From what I have seen of him, it would be the wars that the Freebirds had with the Von Erichs, and it would be some of those tag team matches that he and Dr. Death had later on. You know, they got put together as a team. The Miracle Violence Connection, which is an awesome name, by the way. And at one point in 1992, they held the WCW and the NWA tag team titles at the same time. He was making more money than he ever did before in his career during that period. He was pulling in around 200 grand a year with WCW, and then he would work something like 24 weeks out of the year in Japan for Giant Baba, making 10 grand a week. So he was doing real well, but he was also a big partier. Lots of booze, lots of drugs, where pills entered the picture. Nobody knows exactly, but they believe it may have started with his trips to Japan. He would fly into Japan 2 days before a tour, whenever he was booked. He would take pills to knock himself out for the flight over, and he would end up spending that first day sleeping it off in his hotel room. So by the time the tour started, you know, the next day, it was all out of his system, he was all rested, and he was all ready to go to work. He was actually supposed to work Hulk Hogan in the main event of a joint Tokyo Dome show. It was WWE, it was New Japan, it was All Japan. This was a big show that was held back in 1990. It was the same show where Bret Hart wrestled Misawa when Misawa was Tiger Mask 2. But this was like a week after WrestleMania 6. It was supposed to be Hogan and Gordy in the main event. Gordy backed out of the match at the last minute. He didn't want to do the job for Hogan. So Stan Hansen took his place instead. So we were deprived of what would have been the one and only Hulk Hogan-Terry Gordy match. That would have happened. And, yeah, I think back to Gordy in the mid to late 80s. And you look at some of that stuff he was doing in Japan. I said it was more in the vein of a Bruiser Brody or a Stan Hansen. And people have said before, you know, would Brody have eventually gone to WWE? Would he have eventually gone there and gotten paid and had a feud with Hogan and did the job for the big leg? We'll never know. I think Hogan and Brody could have been an amazing program. But I wonder if Gordy, you know, you think back to that, if Gordy against Hogan would have been a money-making program. I don't know, Gordy, I don't know if Gordy is the kind of person that Vince McMahon would have had any interest in pushing. I guess not, since originally he brought in the Freebirds and really just had plans for Michael Hayes, not so much the rest of them. But I think that if Gordy would have come in as this monster ass kicker, yeah, you could have built up somebody like him for a feud with Hogan. In 88, 89. I think that could have made them some money. But anyway, 3 months later, right, they have this joint show at the Tokyo Dome. Gordy pulls out, but he's on top of the world. He's making good money, right? He's got all these tag team titles. 3 months later came his first drug overdose. He and Doc, they were out one night in Roppongi. Gordy was taking Halcyon pills. He collapses. And they had footage from an old Dr. Death shoot interview where he was describing, you know, he's doing CPR on him until the ambulance came to take him to the hospital. When Gordy woke up, he didn't remember anything. He did not remember anything that happened. And then on August 18th, 1993, came the second overdose, which almost killed him, and it forever changed his life. Terry Gordy, the wrestling prodigy, died on that trip. First, he had so many pills in his system, Doc had to wheel him through the airport in a wheelchair just to get him on the plane. He gets on the plane, he swallows 50 somas, which are muscle relaxers, okay, 50 of them. And they're about 30 minutes from landing in Japan. Doc looks over, he sees Terry, he's turning blue. He's sucking air like he was about to swallow his tongue. And he said in the past, when he gets like this, he would smack him across the face a few times to kind of wake him up and snap him out of it. So that's what he did here. He tried slapping him a few times across the face. Usually it worked. This time it didn't work. And he knew that he was dying. And as soon as they landed, because they were 30 minutes away from landing in Japan, as soon as they land, the ambulance was already there. They rushed him to the hospital. He was in a coma for 2 days. And he survived. He came out of it. But he was never the same. You know, he had lost a lot of his motor skills. He was very slow to react. He suffered permanent damage. You know, he suffered brain damage. And he had to relearn how to do a lot of things, including how to wrestle. If you look at him, and they had footage of him at different shows, you know, post-overdose, there's just this look in his eye. You know what it reminds me of, in a way, when I'm looking at Gordy in some of these images? It reminds me of Perk Angle from TNA. Perk Angle gets talked about a lot. He was a wrestling machine, But you would look at him, and he had this glassy, faraway stare in his eyes, like, the lights are on, but nobody's home. This guy is out to lunch, and we don't know when he's coming back. But yet he would go out there and he would perform. He never missed a beat. The man was a machine. But it was scary. You know, I got to meet Kurt at one of the TNA shows. They came to Webster Hall in New York, and I got to be in the ring with him, and I'm looking at him, and I look at the photo sometimes. He took a Polaroid that night, and it's just, again, he had that look in his eyes. It was scary. And that's kind of the vibe I get when I look at these images post-overdose of Terry Gordy. There's just this lifelessness to that stare. Like, whatever life was there behind his eyes before was just wiped out. Cornette got very emotional. I think only the second time I can remember him getting this emotional in one of these episodes, the other one being the Owen Hart one. When he heard that Gordy was doing independent shows again, he thought to himself, man, if this guy is anything close to what he used to be, we got to get him here in Smoky Mountain. And they brought Gordy in, and he just wasn't the same. He couldn't do a promo anymore like he used to. And they all kept hoping that over time, maybe it'll all come back to him, and it just never did. And he told this one story. He goes, he'd be standing around, Cornette would be. And he remembers one day he just kind of turned around, and it's like he was spooked because Terry was standing right behind him. And he asked him, you know, Terry, do you need anything? And he goes, Jim, I was just wondering if you want me to do the powerbomb. And he was like, well, yes, Terry, if you want to do the powerbomb, you can do the powerbomb. It's just he wasn't the same person. You know, he looked the same. He had the same frame. He was doing the same moves. He would do the powerbomb, and he's just kind of going through the motions, but there was no life to it. And they talked to Mick Foley, who wrestled Terry in an IWA King of the Death match. And they had this hardcore match with all kinds of weapons and stuff. It was a tournament, and they wrestled in the first round. And Foley said that Gordy had some of the best punches in wrestling. He had one of the best work punches in the business, but it was obvious that his punches were not there anymore. And he was concerned for him, like out of respect for him, he didn't want him to go out there and embarrass himself. And he told Terry, he goes, look, Terry, when we go out there, like you got to bring those punches, like bring them legit. And he says to his credit, Terry didn't have to be told twice. And he went out there and, they had what Mick thought was a pretty good match. And he thought maybe we had just turned back the hands of time a little bit, but it just wasn't meant to be. And his daughter said that Terry continued to wrestle after the accident because it's all he ever knew how to do. I told you before, he dropped out of school in the ninth grade. You know, he didn't have a degree. He didn't have any other skills that he had applied to other jobs early in his life. He didn't know how to do anything else. This is all he ever knew. And he popped up in ECW. I believe he wrestled Raven during that time in ECW, and they had what people thought was a very good match, which I think Raven subsequently said was, you know, it was kind of all smoke and mirrors, and he did what he could, but again, there just wasn't much to work with there. Now, they had footage, and this is one of the saddest parts of the entire episode. They had footage of an interview that I did not even know existed. Terry sat down not long before his death. It was only a few years before his death. It was in 1998. He sat down for a shoot interview with RF Video. And his daughter was very upset when she first saw the interview because, you could hear Rob Feinstein in the background just hounding this guy with questions. And it pissed her off because she just wanted him to leave her father alone. He doesn't have anything to say. You know, Feinstein's trying to get stuff out of him. And can you talk about this and that story? And what was it like to work here and work with this person? And you could see he's struggling to come up with the words or the memories because he probably just doesn't remember. And he's giving these very basic answers without any kind of details to it. It was very depressing to see. And a lot of his answers were, I don't remember, this guy, he was a good guy. He apologized at one point, just randomly apologized. They're like, for what? And he goes, well, for the overdose. And, basically because he couldn't remember anything. So he felt like he had to apologize to people. And there were people who were upset because after he passed away in 01, I think RF Video re-released the interview, and you know, people thought that he was exploiting his death. I think Feinstein's argument was, no, we're, you know, celebrating his life. It's like, yeah, okay. But it's just sad to watch. It's sad to see. And they talked about his run in WWE, which came 2 years before he sat down for that interview. In 96, they brought him in as the executioner, and this I remember. They brought him in under a hood with Paul Bearer and Mankind as the executioner. And his daughter was actually glad they put him under a hood because she saw it as a sign of respect. They didn't want to put Gordy out there as himself. They didn't want to put him out there as Terry Gordy when he could not be Terry Gordy anymore. So they kind of hid him away. It was pretty obvious if you knew who he was. It wasn't like you can't... You look, you could clearly see through the mask who it is. But to the general audience, again, there was never any mention of Gordy. There was nothing. He was just the executioner. That's what he was. And Michael Hayes, I think, in the tweet that he posted when he talked about the episode being fairly accurate, he did say there was one thing that wasn't. And I'm still not quite clear on exactly what he was saying. What I got out of the tweet was, in the episode, they inferred that Hayes got his friend a job in WWE. It seems like in the tweet he's disputing that and saying that that wasn't the case, or that he had no knowledge of them bringing him in. I find that very hard to believe. I mean, they were not going to give this guy a job randomly. I'm sure Hayes probably put the word in for him, and he got his friend a job, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I would be surprised if Michael Hayes didn't have anything to do with them out of nowhere, you know, bringing in Terry Gordy and giving him a job in WWE. But they showed some footage from the match he had at one of the In Your House pay-per-views against The Undertaker. And it was Undertaker. According to Cornette, it was Undertaker who said, look, this just isn't going to work. You know, he made the call. Like, we're trying here, but this just is not going to work. They all love the guy, but he just couldn't do it anymore. Mick Foley mentioned a story of Terry talking to a woman on a plane. And he would sit down on the plane and total stranger next to him. This woman pulls out some pills. She pills out on the plane. She pulls out some pills. Say that 10 times fast. And Terry just looks over, has no knowledge of what the pills are, what they do. And he just says to the woman, like, got any extras? And he would just take random pills without even knowing what they were for. You know, he would go from coherent 1 second to completely under the influence within a matter of minutes. And there were times on the road during that WWE run, and this is part of what led to the end of that run, where he and Paul Bearer would have to track Terry down. They couldn't find him in his hotel room, and they had to go out and search for him and call out his name to try to find where he was. And he said this just wasn't going to work. This could not be a long-term thing. And his run came to an end. So he ended up back on the independent scene in Georgia and Tennessee. And his daughter said that those shows were always very sad. And Mick said he saw Terry at one of those shows. Nobody was going into the ring after the show was over to get his photo or his autograph. Mick was signing, and he felt guilty because everybody was waiting in line to see Mick Foley, and nobody was waiting for Terry Gordy. And he said he just felt like he wanted to yell at them and say, look, that's a legend in the ring. Why are you with me? You should want to see him instead. So the one good thing, though, about the last few years of his life is that he was home more often. So his son says that he got to see his dad more than he ever got to see him in his entire life. They became best friends. They would do things together. And he got to know his dad in a way that, you know, previously he never did. So he was grateful to have that time with him. And Terry was going to be doing an independent show. He had asked his son to be his tag team partner one night. And Ray said he couldn't go, and it was the next day when he got the phone call from Richard, who was Gordy's nephew, who told him, look, get on your knees and start praying because your dad stopped breathing. And Terry was found, he was unresponsive in his home. It was after the night after a show. They were doing CPR. Richard tried slapping him in the face like Doc used to because he thought maybe this will work, but he was already gone. And that was on July 16th, 2001. Terry died from congestive heart failure due to a blood clot at the age of 40. 6 days before that, so not even a week before he passed away, he was backstage visiting at a SmackDown taping, and he was visiting with Michael Hayes and Jim Ross, and Gerald Briscoe was there, and seeing all the stars, and he seemed to be as clear-headed as anybody ever remembered him being since the overdose. He seemed to be in a good place. He was coherent, and he was having conversations with people, and this was only 6 days before he died. But you know how in a lot of these other episodes, or when people pass away, legends pass away, you hear me often, unfortunately, talk about how nobody came to the funeral, or two people came to the funeral. Well, he had more than 300 people who attended his funeral. He was the polar opposite of all those other stories you've heard me talk about Mean Gene and Sherry and these different people who passed away. He had a few hundred people who showed up to pay respects to him after he passed away. And so when the episode was over, obviously it was a sad ending. Now, very similar to the John Tenta episode in that way. I mean, the differences here were pretty glaring in that they talked about how much this guy partied, and he did a lot of things that he shouldn't have been doing, and ultimately it led to the problems that he had. That wasn't the case with Tenta, but Tenta, you know, the sense you got from everybody is he was a nice guy, great to be around, great to work with. He got dealt a bad hand at the end of his life. He got sick and he passed away far too soon. In the case of Gordy, again, a lot of it was self-inflicted. The abuse he put himself through with that style when he was in Japan, the traveling back and forth, the injuries, and then the pills. And it all added up, unfortunately, and it really did him in at an early age. But everybody loved Terry. Nobody had a bad word to say about him. You know, they considered him a friend. He was a nice guy, super talented, and cut short. You know, his life and career cut short far too soon. So that's kind of the story of Terry Gordy there. But somebody who had, for the time he was in wrestling and he was on his A-game, he worked everywhere there was to work. He was in all the big regional territories of the 70s and the 80s. Obviously, I mentioned the world-class stuff. He was in Mid-South, briefly in WWE, had a little cup of coffee there. But he worked WCW, ECW, became a big name in Japan. He worked everywhere. And he was part of one of the most famous groups in the history of the business. He held multiple championships, and he'll go down as one in a very long line of what-if stories. What if, right? What if he didn't have that overdose? What if he got his act together? What if he got a proper run in a place like WWE? How big could he have become? Unfortunately, we'll never know the answer to that question. Mailbag time. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com, if you have a question for the mailbag. Just remember to include your name and where you are from. Please, 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 when you write in. Let's take a few questions here. We'll start with Sam from South Park, Pennsylvania. Yes, Sam from South Park. Watching the Last Woman Standing match on Monday night got me thinking. What are your top five Last Man Standing matches? I was having trouble thinking of five really good ones, so I thought I would get your opinion on the matter. Well, my favorite is still the one from Fully Loaded in 2000 with Triple H and Chris Jericho. I thought that was an incredible match. But I don't have five favorite Last Man Standing matches. I was thinking about it, and I came up with a few here, but I don't really have a list of five solid choices for you. I generally find them very boring. It's not my favorite match stipulation, but there have been a few gems. John Cena and Umaga, they had a great one at the Royal Rumble in 2007 that's worth watching. Cena choked him out legit with that ring rope, by the way. Mike Chioda thought Umaga was just doing a good job of selling. Like, no, he was being choked unconscious, and he couldn't get the words out to Chioda to tell Cena to ease up, and for a few seconds there he passed out. Cena and Randy Orton had a pretty good one, from what I remember at Backlash 1 year. It was the one where Big Show threw Cena through a giant spotlight at the end, and then it exploded. And that's about it for me. Those are the only ones I can really name for you. I know people rave about Shawn Michaels and Triple H from the Royal Rumble in 2004. I never saw what the big deal was about that match. You know, I thought some of their matches were very self-indulgent and just kind of dragged on longer than they had to. That is not one of my favorites. Jason from Rhode Island. I recently read an article by Bleacher Report Sports claiming that Cody Rhodes has surpassed Roman Reigns as the face of WWE. Would you agree? There's no answer I can give you that won't piss some people off. But yes, I agree. I think Cody Rhodes is positioned right now as the face of WWE. I think at WrestleMania they will complete the package by putting the belt on him, but if you look at everything they've been doing with him over the past year, even though he lost last year, Roman still is the champion, and he's still kind of the final boss. I mean, all due respect to The Rock, you know, still positioned as the final boss in WWE. He's beaten everybody there is to beat. Cody is the one who's out there every single week, not Roman. You know, Cody's out there every week. He's doing the live events. He's having all these interactions with the fans, and he's doing all of these different things. And they have him on the cover of the video game, and they have him on the cover of a whole bunch of different things. To me, if you think in your mind how you would define the face of the company, the way you define it may be different. It doesn't necessarily need to be the champion, right? If The Rock, for example, came back full-time, and he's on TV every week, he's not the champion, but how could you say The Rock isn't the face of WWE? You know what I mean? John Cena was the face of the WWE for years. He wasn't champion that entire time, but that didn't mean that he wasn't the face of the company. He was the guy they put out there at those media events. He was the guy they put out there on the posters and the magazine covers and the game covers. And he was the one who was out there in pay-per-view main events, whether he was the champion and the title was on the line or not. Sometimes the champion would be pushed down the card just so John Cena could get his main event in with John Laurinaitis, for example. What a fucking great idea that was. So Cody is kind of in that position now. He's in the Cena position in many ways. And he is in the main events. And he is the one who's out there more frequently. He is the face of WWE right now. Not Roman Reigns. Kevin in Albany. The build to WrestleMania 40 has been great. The only potential problem, which they may fix over the next 2 weeks, is that the build has been centered around Cody against The Rock. The Rock being called the final boss surely is part of the plan, and there is a plan behind it. So after the main event on Sunday, what happens first? Cody versus The Rock or Roman versus The Rock? I mean, you watch the shows and you think to yourself, how do they not do Rock against Cody? But I don't see it. I don't see it happening. Especially if we come to find out that Rock was in cahoots with Cody the entire time. There's so many different ways they can go with that main event on night two, where it was all a ruse and they're working together to get that belt off of Roman because he's an embarrassment to the family. He's shaming the family. That would be one way. I don't know that that's the way they're going to go with it. If that's the way they go with it, then we're not getting Rock and Cody, right? That's obviously off the table. But if not, I mean, look, Rock is not going to be around much after WrestleMania anyway. I think the beginning of May, he's going off to film a movie for a few months. And I don't see Rock wrestling a singles match and losing before he gets his eventual match with Roman Reigns, which probably is not happening until WrestleMania 41. They're not going to do, for example, Rock and Cody at SummerSlam and just have Cody beat The Rock and then go on to do Rock and Roman at WrestleMania. I just don't see it. So I think we get Rock and Roman before we ever get Rock and Cody, if we ever get Rock and Cody. You want to see Rock and Cody, WrestleMania Night 1 is probably going to be the closest you're going to get. The only way I can envision Rock against Cody being done first and Rock losing to Cody before he eventually fights Roman, the only way it makes sense to me is if, in fact, Roman loses at WrestleMania and gets booted out of the bloodline, and Roman goes away for a few months. And Rock's going to go away for a few months too. They'd be losing both of them. But they boot him out, and then Rock comes back in time to challenge Cody to a title match at SummerSlam in Cleveland. And that's when Roman returns. And so if Rock plays a role in Roman's downfall on night two at WrestleMania, and costs him the title, or prevents the other members of the bloodline from helping him, and that costs him the title. Roman comes back, gets his revenge on Rock by costing him the match against Cody, and now they've both lost to Cody, and then you go on to do Rock and Roman, but even that, it just seems very unrealistic to me. I just don't see them going down that path. I don't see it. Jerry from San Antonio. What would you say if Gunther defeats Sami Zayn at WrestleMania, only to main event Backlash in France against Chad Gable to lose the IC title there? Gunther wins at WrestleMania, and fans believe that this will lead to another year with him as champion, only to have Gable beat Sami to get the next shot at the title in France. The people believe Gable will end up being another body for Gunther and ends the historic reign. I want to believe that they still have a plan for Chad Gable to finish his own story and beat Gunther and get the title in the end. I really hope they come back to it. I don't see that happening in Backlash. I don't. And each month that goes by, each time we see Gable lose in one of these situations, it becomes less and less and less likely. He's still on TV, though. I mean, he was on television on Monday night in the back. A couple of those promo segments with Sami Zayn trying to explain to him why he doesn't believe in him, why he doesn't believe that Sami can beat Gunther. So they're doing something with Gable. I don't know exactly where they're headed with it, if they're going to turn him heel or what they're going to do. But I don't know. I'm just, as somebody who really wants to see him be the one to beat him and take that Intercontinental title, you know, they've kind of beaten it out of me almost, where I just don't have any faith at this point that it's actually going to happen. So I don't see it. James from New York. If WWE was to introduce women's Intercontinental and United States titles, who would you have as the inaugural winners? Well, I don't think they need Intercontinental and U.S. titles for the women. I would start out with a women's Intercontinental title. And if they can strengthen the individual divisions a little bit more, then maybe introduce a U.S. title later on. But if they debuted both, I look at the rosters, I would give it to Ivy Nile. I would give the Intercontinental title to Ivy Nile on Raw, give her a shot to get over with that. And on SmackDown, I would make Tiffany Stratton the inaugural U.S. champion. Now, if they did it my way, as Sinatra said, I would have Adam Pearce and Nick Aldis come together, and they come to an understanding that we have come up with something very cool that we want to share with all of you, and we are working together for a cross-branded, first-ever women's intercontinental title, or whatever they want to call it. And they have a tournament, and they have talent from both brands, and they have Tiffany Stratton win the entire thing. And then Tiffany would be able to defend that title across both shows. And then, like I said, if that goes well, after a period of time goes by, they could always introduce a U.S. title later on, and then they can keep each one exclusive to their respective brand. But I would not just, you know, come up with two brand new belts and just throw them out there. I think you do one. You have a women's IC, cross-branded, test that out, see how it goes, put it on Tiffany Stratton, can always come back around later on and say, hey, we're going to introduce a U.S. title now. Matt from New Jersey, he posted this in the Facebook group. He wanted to pose the question now to me. Are Edge and Christian the best rivalry from a tag team in history? If not, who do you think it is? Some people suggested the Brothers of Destruction, but they started out as rivals. The Mega Powers were more of an angle than an actual team. DIY was one of the only others that came up that would be in the conversation. What do you think? I think it would have to be Edge and Christian. I mean, who else would it be? You know, they tried it with so many other teams, and it rarely works. I mean, I wouldn't count Undertaker and Kane either. I would not count Bret Hart and Owen Hart because they weren't a team for very long. They only worked as a handful of matches together as partners. I wish I could say Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty went on to have this memorable feud after the Rockers split, but they really didn't. You know, Jannetty's personal problems got in the way of that, or else maybe they would have, but they didn't. It was very underwhelming. Bret Hart and Jim Neidhart, right, one of my all-time favorite teams, the Hart Foundation, they had some matches after Anvil came back in 94. He aligned with Owen, so he was a heel. Bret was a babyface. So we got some Bret Hart, Jim Neidhart matches, but they were all dark matches and house show matches and nothing ever on TV or on pay-per-view. The Hardy Boys is the other one I think of, and I didn't think it was that good either of the times they tried it. You know, Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit, they were briefly the tag team champions for a few weeks. And then they went out and they had that classic match at the Royal Rumble in 2003. But they weren't a real team like Edge and Christian were. So I would say Edge and Christian. You know, now you have a feud with Edge and Christian where it has spanned multiple promotions, and you can point to them having multiple great matches together in both companies. But I think what it really illustrates is just how few teams there have been that have split and then went on to have any sort of classic feud. It's hard to come by. Keegan from Mississippi. Which WWE Hall of Fame class would you consider to be the most stacked lineup to be inducted in a single year? For me, I would consider it either 2004 or 2013. What say you? For me, it's either 2004 or 2009. I would lean towards 2004, though. That was when they brought the Hall of Fame back. It was on ice for many years. I think the last induction maybe was 96. And they brought it back in 04. They decided, hey, we can market this. And that was when they just went wild with the inductees. They had so many people that went in that year. They had Harley Race, because I had to look up. I actually, in my head, I thought I remembered everybody, and I left out three people. They had Harley Race, Superstar Billy Graham, Big John Studd, Don Morocco, Greg Valentine, Junkyard Dog, Sergeant Slaughter, Tito Santana, Jesse Ventura, Bobby the Brain Heenan, and Pete Rose. Now you look at 2009. 2009 had Stone Cold Steve Austin, Ricky Steamboat, Cowboy Bill Watts, Howard Finkel, Coco Beware, The Funks, and the Von Erichs. Now the Funks and the Von Erichs going in together, that alone is a pretty strong lineup. Then you throw in Stone Cold, you throw in the Dragon, I Love the Fink, Bill Watts obviously made his mark on the industry, and then Coco's in there. But you look at that 2009 class, that's a pretty strong class. But I gotta go with 2004. See, I much preferred the Hall of Fame before they turned it into an arena show. And the Hall of Fame in 2004 was still, I don't remember exactly where it was, what the building was, but it wasn't an arena. It was still, it was like the last banquet type Hall of Fame that they did. And I much prefer the Hall of Fame ceremonies back then. Plus, Bobby Heenan still has the best Hall of Fame speech I ever saw. Undertaker's TED Talk is close. He's the closest anybody has come to Bobby. But Bobby's is still my favorite. And I tear up every time I come across the clip of him at the end saying he wished Monsoon was still there. It still breaks my heart. Neil from Chicago. Should Leah Maivia's induction into the WWE Hall of Fame have been saved for next year's class? I ask this because with everything going on for WrestleMania, I can see a scenario where the crowd tries to take over and shit all over this part of the ceremony. I hope that doesn't happen, but I can see this induction having a negative reaction from the crowd. If she goes in, they still have not said anything about her yet. The only two names that have yet to be announced for the Hall of Fame that were on that list that was floating around on Reddit, the rest of the list has proven to be accurate, but the only two names that have yet to be announced are Leah Maivia and Bray Wyatt. And according to Meltzer, Bray is not going in this year. They made the decision that they're going to push that off for another year. So we'll see. There's still 2 weeks left to announce her, but she still has not been announced. If they do put her in, hopefully the people are respectful. But look, you know, these are wrestling fans that you're dealing with here. That's the risk you run when you do a Hall of Fame ceremony in front of a live crowd. Unfortunately, that's the sort of thing that might happen. Tal from the Facebook group. I was watching an episode of Wrestling with Regret, and an interview with Greg the Hammer Valentine came up, and I have three questions for you. Number one, what are the top three matches that Valentine has ever been involved in? Number two, was Greg a part of your childhood during the early 90s? And number three, where does Greg stand in the history of the TV era of wrestling? Well, Valentine was part of my wrestling childhood in the 80s, not so much in the 90s. He was part of Vince McMahon's national expansion, so he got lots. I mean, he was part of that era when the expansion happened, so he got a lot of exposure on television. He got a lot of exposure on shows like Saturday Night's Main Event. I can't speak to a lot of Valentine's early work, except the dog collar match that he had at the first Starrcade with Roddy Piper. I mean, that to me has to be his most famous match. That's probably his best match. I don't have too many great Greg Valentine matches to share with you. He, you know, he wasn't ever one of my favorites. He was not a flashy worker. He was good. He's a good wrestler. But a lot of his work just sort of, you know, blends together. I'll give you one more, though. I'll give you one more match. I just thought of it. The Dream Team against the British Bulldogs at WrestleMania 2. That was a very good match. That was probably the best actual match on the entire WrestleMania 2 card. I just remember Dynamite Kid going splat on the ground at the very end. Like, right at the finish. He was out on the apron. He was on the ropes. And I think maybe Davey got knocked into him or something, and he just fell backwards, and you heard the splat on the mats outside. And then Davey got the win for the team. But yeah, I would put that on the list. If you never saw it, it's a match. I mean, you might watch the match now and think, okay, what's so special about it? But for that time, I think that would have been considered a very good match. Today, because we get so many matches on television every week, I mean, we're kind of inundated with very good matches and great matches. I could see newer fans watching it and going, okay, what's so special about this? But I'd put that on the list. Mike in Lakeland, Florida, at the height of her popularity as the Man, do you feel like WWE missed an opportunity to induct Velvet McIntyre into the WWE Hall of Fame with Becky doing the induction? In your opinion, do you feel like Velvet deserves a Hall of Fame induction? I think so. You know, Velvet was a staple of the television show back in the 80s whenever they had a women's match. I don't recall her ever being used as a top name. Although she did briefly hold the women's title. It was only for a few days, but she was a former WWE women's champion. She was a women's tag team champion. So I don't see why not. Josh in Arlington Heights, Illinois. Have you heard about Hulk Hogan telling the story of the Montreal Screwjob as having occurred at WrestleMania X7, which, as you know, took place in Houston? Yes, years ago. I heard that years ago. He was on some radio show or podcast or whatever it was. Actually, what he said it happened at WrestleMania 16 or 17, and you left out the best part, that Shawn Michaels held down Bret Hart and pinned him and couldn't do anything about it. He got every single detail about that night wrong, from the location to the event title, to the actual finish of the match. It's actually awesomely impressive how badly he fucked that up. And Michael from Liverpool, England. Which memorable moment in wrestling, when you look back on when it happened, received a disappointing reaction from the live crowd at the time? Well, I was there, so I can vouch. They built a 3-year story out of John Cena beating The Rock at WrestleMania 29. And having Rock raise his arm to endorse him. And I would not call that the reaction they were hoping to get. The payoff did not fit the time that they invested in it. Let's just say the fans were not very happy with that finish. Tito Ortiz. I think of Tito Ortiz in TNA. His debut in TNA was pretty damn memorable, but not for the reasons they intended. That reaction was something else. You never saw that before. Go on YouTube and find it. Impact might actually have the full thing up on their YouTube channel. And I don't remember at this point what year it was. My God, I've been doing this for so long. But what I remember is Ortiz walked out. He like stood there on the ramp and had his arms crossed. It had to be 2012 or 2013. Because this is going back to the Aces and Eights era. And they cut to the Aces and Eights and just everybody who was already out of ringside. I remember Ken Kennedy, the look on his face, he's scratching his head like he's confused. Just the reaction was like, what is going on here? Like, yeah, it was weird. It was very weird. So make sure you go find that. Anyway, thank you guys for the questions. Keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I jump back and forth. I try to pull some stuff that has been sitting there for a few weeks and try to pull some current ones. I do read everything you send me. I try to get them on the show. I can't get everybody, but I will keep trying. So email me and follow me on Twitter as well, @Solomonster. You could also subscribe on the YouTube channel, Solomonster Sounds Off. You guys know I'm live each and every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and for pay-per-views as well. So make sure you hit me up on there. Plus all the new episodes that go up of Sound Off Gamer, should there be new ones. If you saw my most recent one that went up this week, you would know what I'm talking about. But any gamer videos will be posted on the YouTube channel as well. Those are always fun. Maybe not so much for me, but hopefully they're fun for you. And again, WrestleMania week is going to be a busy week, and I'm very excited to be part of it and be doing what I am doing in Philly. And I thank the Fox Sports team there for having me in the Thursday before to do WrestleMania predictions in their Dunkin' Lounge. Again, get in touch with me. Tweet me, email me, let me know if you want to attend and you want to drop by the studio so I can get a sense of how many people we're talking about here. But I'm very much looking forward to what's coming up in these next few weeks and next Sunday when I am back with you for episode 855 of the Sound Off. That will be the final Sound Off before night one of WrestleMania. It's the weekend before WrestleMania, so that's coming up next Sunday. Be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and I will see you back here for more Sound Off very soon. A lot of content coming up. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonsters Sounds Off.
Kareem points out, we celebrated the fact that we just had our first full week, all bells and be the booker, but we have a pay-per-view. I may have celebrated a little too soon. The Green Pianist says, Kareem is the kid in class that reminds the teacher about homework.
Teacher, oh teacher, you forgot to give us homework. We need homework. You have one more be the booker. Don't forget. One more! Teacher!
I say tomorrow we hang Kareem upside down and shake him so his lunch money falls out of his pocket. Then we'll throw him in his locker and we'll lock him in there. How about that?
Teacher!
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
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 Solomonster Sounds Off.